This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2021, held at Faith Builders from August 2 through 6.
Good morning to all of you, and I trust that you've had rest and time for meditation and reflection. I trust that you've experienced the goodness of God so far this week, and the words you've heard, and the songs you've sang, and the expressions you've shared with friends and people around you. I'm still recovering from the Amy Carmichael poem that we just sang. It's easy when we're in the middle of something difficult to just want to get through it and ask God why this is and what have I done to deserve this, when really the question could be, what would you have me learn in this situation? And realize when you're in leadership, there are always going to be situations. And so the prayer is to increase our capacity to sacrifice and love the people we are responsible for. We're looking today at a bit at valuing and believing truth. Our subtitle is Teaching Students to Discern. Value, believe, and live truth. The words do mean different things, but when I try to break it down into those categories, I realize they start to kind of muddle together. It's a little hard to keep them separate, but we're doing some of that. At any rate, when we think about it, truth is one thing, one person, right? So how do we get students to think in a Christ-like way and to live out reality is what we're trying to do. I wanted to begin this morning with a passage a bit similar to Psalm 78 that we looked at yesterday. In fact, it may feel a bit repetitive in some ways. I do this partly because it's Scripture and I have more confidence in the Scripture than anything I can say. And so, in case I don't have anything that's worth hearing, I think at least these Scriptures are there, and I hope that you will take them with you and continue to study and unpack the timeless truths that are there. So the passage is Psalm 143, verses 5 to 10. I remember the days of old. I meditate on all thy works. I muse on the work of thy hands. I stretch forth my hands unto thee. My soul thirsteth after thee as a thirsty land. Hear me speedily, O Lord. My spirit faileth. Hide not thy face from me, lest I be like unto them that go down into the pit. Cause me to hear thy loving kindness in the morning. For in thee do I trust. Cause me to know the way wherein I should walk, for I lift up my soul unto thee. Deliver me, O Lord, from mine enemies. I flee unto thee to hide me. Teach me to do thy will, for thou art my God. Thy spirit is good. Lead me into the land of uprightness. We've been reading slowly through the Psalms as a family, and we've noticed that they frequently refer to past events, great events that dwelled in the collective memory of the Hebrews. The Exodus, the Red Sea, manna, water from the rock, Canaan. Collective memories help create a common identity and rootedness and values. You could think about national holidays or family gatherings. Think about the activities that are done on a repeated basis, on a regular schedule. Think about the stories that are told and retold and the creative and imaginative power they have. I often put my children to bed and they want me to come and lay down beside me Come lay down beside me, Daddy. And then what do they want next? They want a story. And I don't have a huge repertoire of stories, but they don't really care if it's the 34th run of number three. It doesn't seem to really matter. They're just glad to have me there with them, telling them a story. And so we've had a little story about Woodcock Dam that Marla and I experienced together before we were married. And we've told them that story. And so last night we went to Woodcock Dam so they could see what happened there. They wanted to do that, right? The psalm here says, remember, meditate, and muse on the work of God. What God has done, what God is doing. And since his character is constant, what he will do. Right? Imagine what God may and will do in the future. Most of life is spent between the great events. So the Exodus was a great event. It's a mile marker for these people. We may have some great events. Perhaps there are public celebrations that we have to memorialize milestones. But the great events that make the books are few and far between. It's the ordinary, same, mundane, most of the time. But the habits and practices we live in that same old routine influence the big events. The big events in our lives didn't just wake up one morning and decide you're going to be baptized, right? It was a confluence of a lot of small decisions that you made in ordinary days and ordinary ways of living. So we look back and see the Exodus, which took, I don't know how long, a day, a week, a month, well, maybe 40 years in one sense. But think about the 400 years before that. 400, that's 12, 15 generations of people. And the many, many years after that. Hearing God's loving kindness or steadfast love can bring resolution to a failing spirit. Cause me to hear thy loving kindness in the morning, for in thee do I trust. The way to walk can be known. It's not a mystery. Hearing and knowing happen by the grace of God. Cause me to hear, cause me to know. And finally, in verse 10, there's a phrase here that is so gracious. Teach me to do thy will, for thou art my God. Thy spirit is good. God's motives are always trustworthy. He is never acting toward me or you or any of us out of frustration or revenge or spite. The spirit or breath is the word for spirit here. The breath of God is good, always good. And so, yes, God really does love me. Jonah spoke the other morning about being Jesus' friend. We had a discussion about this in Bible class last year. We were studying some of Paul's writings, and Paul emphasizes the servanthood aspect. And the word servant, as Jonas mentioned, often means slave. And Paul identified himself as a slave to Jesus and Jesus' people. And some of my students really had a hard time with that. Slaves? It doesn't describe the kind of relationship that I know I can have, and my at least my idea of what a slave is. And I was thinking about that more later, and it's true. As Jonah said, Jesus talks about us as being his friends as well. But I wondered then later, if God is truly good, if his spirit is good, his breath is fragrant, does it really matter if I'm his slave or his friend? Does it really matter what the vocabulary is there? Not sure. Teaching students to value truth. Value is the importance or worth or usefulness of something. The Greek word in the New Testament means to prize or revere. It's most often translated honor, as in honor your father and mother. A high value means a high priority. Now, think about someone you know, a friend perhaps, someone you know well. When you have a close, intimate, heart-to-heart conversation with that person, and you come away from that, what's the thing that drives that person? What do they really care about? What can they talk about passionately for a long time? I remember an uncle who was a dairy farmer. He was quiet, normally. He had nothing to say in a crowd, and not usually so much one-on-one. But if you got to discussing seed corn, Pioneer was close to his heart. Pioneer corn was the best. And you knew that he cared about that because suddenly he was passionate, he was animated, he was sure about this. So what turns your crank? What do you get emotional about? What makes you angry, sad, excited, happy? Maybe some of you stopped at Tim Hortons and you just felt so happy with that cup of coffee. It just made you so, you just were so in love with this thing. That caffeine addiction really does do something, doesn't it? Okay. I drink some coffee too, but Tim Hortons isn't good enough for me. Okay, so the answer to these questions is, whatever it is, that thing that turns your crank, that wakes you up, is a value that you hold or your friend holds. It's something you value. You care about it. We will sacrifice for a value. We will sacrifice sleep. We will sacrifice money, time, comfort, all those things we are willing to deny ourselves for the sake of a value, a strongly held value. And typically our choices are subconsciously value driven. So you can think about that if you stopped at Tim Hortons this morning. What was the value that caused you to spend the time and resources to do that? And if that's a habit for you, have you questioned those values that are undergirding that particular habit? A value is something I'm willing to pay for in some way or other. We will sacrifice for a value, and they're often choices are subconsciously value driven. I don't know what you see here, what comes to your mind when you see this. It's not a trick slide, it's a lawn. And I would propose that it's probably in America somewhere. Yeah. And someone has a system going on, don't they? Someone is paying attention to some details on this piece of turf. So the state of Pennsylvania is about 29 million acres, a little more than 29 million acres in our state here in Pennsylvania. How many acres of this stuff do you think we have in the United States? Some estimates are over 40 million acres of this stuff. Okay. Now we have some at our house. We live on a 0.49 acre lot with, I think, something like 17 trees and 5 children in a house. And the stuff we have at our house, I'm telling you, gets used. You can run a lot of laps around that thing when there's excess energy. And so we struggle to keep it growing because it is used. But I've noticed that the majority of this stuff, the only thing you ever see on it is, the only time there's a person on it is when they're riding something. They're maintaining it. This 40 million acres covers nearly 2% of the continental U.S. In some states, like New Jersey and Delaware, it's as high as 20% of the state is covered by turf. Now, turf's not all bad, for sure. But the average American household spends about $1,200 a year maintaining their, what I'm going to suggest is American value. It's part of the American dream, a big front lawn. Turf grass is the single largest irrigated crop in the United States. In contrast, corn, which is the most popular crop by a long shot, covers about 92 million acres this year. We said 40 million acres of grass. But the irrigated part of this is 3 times what corn is. In the book entitled The Lawn, A History of an American Obsession, the author traces this to the historical desire to kill weeds. She notes that the current rage for a chemically dependent lawn emerged after World War II and argues that American front lawns are a symbol of man's control of or superiority over his environment. So I just picked on something that I have a particular beef with, in case you didn't notice. What would you suggest, however, what would you suggest for some significant values in American culture? It would be interesting to give you a little time to think about that. Now, I know our subject is teaching values, but it's helpful to think about what the values might be first. According to the Hello USA website, which from what I can tell is meant to be a website to introduce immigrants to the American way of life and to help them become at home here, it's a part of the website where they list values and try to help people understand why people might do what they do. And so here are some of the values they listed. Independence, privacy, equality, and they clarified it's the idea of equality, not necessarily equality. Informality, competition, time and efficiency, work ethic, and consumerism. So if this is accurate, and you are living in America, which I guess you all are, at least right now, these are some of the values that are going to be pressing on your students, right? I thought of a few. Freedom. I was just with a group of young men the other day, like last Sunday morning actually, we went for a jog over at Greenwood Furnace State Park, did a 6-mile loop, and then some of us jumped into the lake there. So this is at 6 o'clock in the morning, it's about 54 degrees, and one of the young men is in there and he's just saying, and the sun is coming up, it's beautiful, all right? And he just exclaimed about the wonder of the freedom we have. This is my lake as much as anybody else's lake, right? And how amazing this is. And most people don't have it this way. So we really camp on that idea, that value. When I think about freedom, I'm often reminded of Amos Fortune, which I reread recently after probably a 30-year gap, and one of his sayings that impressed me again. I don't know if it impressed me before or not, but it did this time. So he invested his life freeing people. And what he said is that it's no use freeing a man unless he knows how to live. Okay, instant gratification, I would suggest, is a value for many of us. The entitlement mentality can be a pretty high value or a way of thinking. Perpetual youth, personal comfort. I think about the slogan that I think that used to be on the Sheets cups. I really am picking on coffee. I don't mean to be that necessarily, but I remember this because in our community there was a new Sheets that opened up a number of years ago, and they had free coffee every morning, I think, and I had some students that would come by there, and so it was pretty convenient just to pull in there and pick up a cup of whatever it was they had. I didn't usually ask them. And on the cup, it said something like this. There's maybe some of you remember this, and I'm not sure if this is accurate, but it said something like, what you want, when you want, how you want. That was the slogan of the beverage. It's that instant gratification, it's that entitlement mentality, I deserve it, it's mine, just the way I want it. Personal comfort. You know, there are many jobs in America that white Americans simply will not do. So that's the larger society. A few bits there. Sports could be considered a high value, perhaps. That would come in with the competition. What are typical Amish Mennonite values? And again, it would be interesting to hear your take on that. Again, I've attempted to list a few. Not a high level of confidence that these are exactly the way it is, but I think they at least resonate with some of us. Family, for us, is a high value. We will sacrifice for that. Community has historically been a high value. Work ethic. For some of us, perhaps this is the final and defining attribute of God, hard work. We might value looking good sometimes. We might sometimes value looking good over being, looking over being. Scripture has been a high value for our people. And perhaps financial success is an unspoken value for us as well. Well, what are godly values then? What are God's values? If we're teaching values that align with truth, with reality, what are those? And really, there are two, from what I can tell. It's love for God and love for a neighbor. Obedience, faithfulness, service. The Old Testament version of this. Micah 6:8, do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly. So the question for values, or the distinction would be godly values versus all others, or selflessness versus selfishness. I have it the other way around here. Our values can be God-centered, they can be I-centered. And for most of us, for all of us, probably there's a mix, right? He's still working on us. Another expression that you may have heard that I thought about with this is the dog and cat theology. And I understand there's even a homeschool curriculum based on this. But dog and cat theology could be expressed something like this. A dog may look at you and think, you feed me, you pet me, you shelter me, you love me, you must be God. A cat looks at you and thinks, you feed me, pet me, shelter me, you love me, I must be God. A different perspective. So how are values shaped and changed? They are shaped by our heroes, the people we look up to, the people we admire. I can see a direct correlation between some of the things I value even today to the gentleman who did not believe in God that I worked for when I was in my upper teens. There were many things that I highly admired about that man. I respect him very highly. And there... So he was a hero to me in some sense. Not in everyone, obviously. But I looked up to him, I still do, and I think about what his response would be in a situation or how he would handle a problem. When we go back to that community, I want to stop and visit him. He's 80, almost 80 years old now. They are caught. I don't want to say they're not taught, but I often think that we as parents and teachers are very successful in transmitting the values we have. It may be, though, that the values we have aren't the values we think we have. There can be a difference there. But there's also the native selfish bent in our children, for sure. People have a choice to make. But I've observed people already who have walked a different trajectory from their parents, and there are still many of their parents' values that follow them, in spite of choosing some things differently. They're still their father's son or daughter. They are absorbed. We're kind of like sponges. We can absorb it from the surrounding medium. How can we reshape them then? Well, so I see Brother Melvin Lehman sitting here, and this comes directly from you. I hope you don't mind. We can create heroes for them. And this is the line, I think, similar, something like this that Brother Melvin has shared already. The stories we tell create the heroes. The heroes have values, we absorb their values. If we're living out of our values, if we believe in what we're doing, we have passion, right? We care about this. And if we're passionate people, we have impact. How do we shape values? Again, by practices, by experiences. Teach history. I've heard numerous of the students at our school speaking a bit differently about our communities when they understood something of what the sacrifice was that went into this movement hundreds of years ago. Students can identify sacrifice. Even if they aren't willing to do it, they know what it can look like. And those stories are powerful, and we need to be teaching them. We need to learn from the dead. So we said here that our values are absorbed from the surrounding medium. Well, what is that medium? Well, it doesn't just have to be social media, or your friends right now, or the people, your peer group in church. You can read books that are written by people who died hundreds of years ago, who had a lot more wisdom than most of us living today do. And they can shape your values. That's a tremendous blessing. Here's an author recommendation. James K. Smith, two books of his that I have particularly appreciated. One is Desiring the Kingdom, the other, You Are What You Love. Talking about desire and how our desires are shaped and how that shapes us. You can think about fads. What's up with fads? Whether it's clothing or dieting or things like smoking or vaping. Think about how that people make decisions, value-based decisions, that they probably, if they stopped and think about it, would realize they're really foolish, actually. So, from stories, we derive heroes. Heroes form our values. When we're living according to our values, we have passion. When we are passionate, we have impact. How do we teach students to value truth? Tell the stories, sing the songs of people who valued truth. Martyr stories, martyr songs. Dirk Willems, the favorite story. Dirk Willems was an Anabaptist, lived in a time when Anabaptism wasn't a popular idea for the authorities. He was confiscated, taken to prison, accused of being rebaptized, etc. Held in prison for a while. At one point, found a way to crawl out the window and escape. Dirk Willems had been a good runner, fast runner. However, the prison diet back then didn't include a lot of high carbs, and so he was emaciated and not as strong as usual. He ran away. The guards saw him pretty promptly, came after him, sent their best runner after him. Dirk ran. The runner behind him was gaining. He came to a body of water with a thin layer of ice. He took the chance. And here's where his emaciated condition helped him. He was light. He managed to cross the ice. His pursuer, who was better fed, didn't. In that crisis, Dirk stopped, came back, pulled out his would-be capturer, who wanted to release him, but the burgomaster on the bank said, no, you must capture him. So Dirk went back to prison, and eventually lost his life, or gained his life, at the stake in a long-lasting fire. That's short in the light of eternity. So what caused him to do that? Our students ought to know that story and other stories like that. A few thoughts on believing. To believe is to accept something as true, to feel sure of the truth of. The Greek use means have faith in and trust and commit. Commit to. Now, I don't know if our beliefs, I sometimes think of them as ranging from 0 to 100. When do you believe something? Do you 100% believe everything you believe? But a strongly held belief is something we're willing to commit to, commit our lives to, and trust in. In John 10, 35 and 36a, then said Jesus unto them, yet a little while is the light with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness come upon you. For he that walketh in darkness knoweth not whither he goeth. While ye have light, believe in the light, that ye may be the children of light. We act on our beliefs. So, if the forecast calls for rain, if I believe that, the evidence would be that I take an umbrella if I'm going outside. We are called to walk. And walking is evidence of belief in the light we have. Don't wait for all the light. Just take what you have and move ahead, and the grace of God will give more, will build your belief. Jesus is the light. There is also apparent belief versus belief. In other words, we can look as though we believe something, but we may not have actually examined it. And therefore, when the pressure is on, there are other beliefs that truly take over, and our lives don't have a stable trajectory because we're actually pretending to believe, and we're pretending to believe the easiest way forward. It would seem to me that all, in order to own a belief fully, it must be questioned. As a teacher, allow your students to question. I used to say that with no restrictions. Recently, I heard a man speaking who I respected highly, and he said, in our homes, we should never question the character of God. I'm still pondering that one. But in general, I think it's true to say that our people, our parents, grandparents, etc., have done a better job of teaching us what to do than why we do it. And as culture continues to decline, I'm talking about the Western culture, the death of Western culture, we have been living with a collective memory that said we, as the Anabaptist peoples, yes, our lives are somewhat different, but in general, we expect our surrounding culture to respect us, and they also have some similar values. But as those values continue to deviate away from reality, the question is whether we're going to go with them, just stay a little different, or are we going to actually maintain and increase our alliance, our alignment with reality? And I'm suggesting that if we're going to increase our line with reality and not simply follow popular culture, we're going to need to think about why. There is one belief that you are to convince your students of, and that is that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Jesus Christ of Nazareth, as portrayed in the scriptures, is the Son of God. How do we do that? We must lay out the historical case at some point. Students must understand that Christianity is a historical faith. Some things actually had to happen, literally had to happen, if Christianity is true. And if a few key things happened then. Everything rests on that. Okay? Our arguments have to include a segment of intellect. I'm going to leave a question or two with you yet here. A question that I wrestle with: how do we become communities where truth is discerned, valued, believed, and lived? How do we become communities of those kinds of people? And in addition to that, what do we do in situations where my values differ significantly from the brother's values? So I would be delighted to discuss these questions with you. My time is up. I do have one quote here. This is from Donald T. Williams from Touchstone Magazine. Here's what he says. In a post-truth, post-facts world, this is still true. The biblical words for truth have faithfulness as their root meaning. The secular mindset thinks of truth simply as faithfulness to the facts. But the biblical view of truth is much richer and deeper. It starts with faithfulness to God. This includes faithfulness to the facts, because they are His facts. All truth is God's truth, right? Part of His creation. But it also entails faithfulness to the covenant, faithfulness to your word, and faithfulness to your neighbor. Ultimately, faithfulness is not an abstraction, but a person, Jesus, who is faithful to the Father and us, even unto death. Our faithfulness must be rooted in and flow from His. This means that we must not just be faithful to the facts, we must be faithful with the facts. We must use them in faithful ways if we are to be true people and thus speak the truth in love. Gossip is false speech, even if it is factually correct, because it is not faithful to my neighbor. The biblical concept of truth, then, is more than factual correctness, but not less. Faithfulness to the facts is a necessity, but not a sufficient condition of biblical truthfulness. We can grow together in discernment, values, beliefs, and living as we personally and communally study the scriptures and the tradition of the church. May God give this generation the grace to be faithful. God help us to that end. God bless you.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.